Good evening, listeners of the New Visions Radio Network, and welcome to the Hour of Madness, hosted by yours truly, Mad Mike, and brought to you courtesy of NewVisionsRadio.com. For the next hour, sit back and let the music you hear soothe your soul, lighten your spirit, stimulate your senses, and excite your imagination. Happy Wednesday to all my listeners on New Visions Radio. I'm Mad Mike, and you're tuned in to the Hour of Madness. That opening song we just heard was There Goes My Baby, sung by the world-famous Drifters, and was released this week in 1959. Tonight I'm introducing a couple new segments to my show, and the first edition is This Week in Rock and Roll History. I'll be highlighting the careers of some of my biggest musical influences and recounting major events that they were part of during this week in rock and roll history. On April 24th, 1959, Atlantic Records released the first 45 by the New Drifters entitled There Goes My Baby. The producers were Jerry Lieber and Mike Stoller, who previously had produced the Coasters. Ahmet Ertegun and Jerry Wexler, Ahmet Ertegun being the owner of Atlantic Records, would have normally been the producers for this recording, but they were tied up in other projects, so it was passed on to Lieber and Stoller. They went on to record numerous top 10 hits, and this recording had five writers. George Treadwell, who was the manager of the Drifters, was listed as one of the writers, Lieber and Stoller, Lover Patterson, who was the road manager of the Drifters and formerly the manager of the Five Crowns, which we'll get into in a moment. The fifth writer was Benjamin Nelson, otherwise known as Benny King. So we should go back and talk about what led up to the Drifters recording for Atlantic. In 1958, They were called the Five Crowns: Ellsbury Hobbs, Benny King, Doc Green, Charlie Thomas, and James Papa Clark. Now, sometime during the summer of 58, Lover Patterson, who was the Five Crowns manager, was approached by George Treadwell, who was then the manager of the early Drifters with Clyde McFadder. He'd been having some problems with the guys and wanted to fire the whole bunch and bring somebody new in. He approached Lover Patterson and said, "Hey, do your guys want to become the new Drifters and fulfill some of the contracts that we still have open for shows?" And, of course, they said yes. Since there was no prior connection with these new guys to the old Drifters, quite often they were playing shows to pretty hostile crowds, so it took a little while for them to become accepted by the Drifters fans. And I think what helped cement it was this first recording in 1959. The song, "There Goes My Baby," was recorded on March 6, 1959, and then released on April 24th. Now, the song, it was basically formed around very loosely structured vocals. At that time, most of the groups who were recording had very tight rhyme schemes. It was kind of like mandatory during that time. So this was kind of like a departure. Also, they weren't singing harmonies. If you notice, everything is unison on this song. Another thing that was different for this recording, the violin was present. The first time that violins ever appeared in any rock music. This style came from the Brazilian productions of that time and was picked up on by Lieber and Stoller and incorporated into rock and roll. Now, the violin was playing kind of sax-like riffs. It was in an R&B style, so it was mainly to enhance the R&B singing. The lead voice was sung in a high gospel-like style. So with this first single in 1959, the New Drifters went on to record a string of hits for Atlantic Records. "This Magic Moment," "Up on the Roof," "Save the Last Dance for Me," "Dance with Me," and the iconic beach song, "Under the Boardwalk," just to name a few. Ironically, only "Save the Last Dance" topped the charts at number one, primarily because they had the bad luck of competing with the Beatles for many of their recordings. Let's listen to one more song by the Drifters.
Don't go, please, don't go, please.
If I got on my knees and I pleaded you not to go but to stay in my arms, would you walk out the door like you did once before? Was it time be different? Would you stay?
Don't go, don't go.
If I call out your name like a prayer tonight, would you leave me alone with my tears, knowing I need your soul? Would you still turn and go? Was it time to be different in some way?
Don't go, please. Don't go, please.
You took me away from the rest of the world when you taught me to love you like this. Now I hang my bread in the canyon of doom, but I still can be saved by your kiss. If I got on my knees and I pleaded with you not to go but to stay in my arms, would you walk out the door like you did once before? Was it time to be different? Would you stay?
Right, that was "Please Stay," the Drifters from 1961, with Charlie Thomas and Tommy Evans with the sonorous bass voice. Well, that was This Week in Rock and Roll History in 1959, and I hope you enjoyed that and found it interesting. I've had the good fortune of becoming good friends with Charlie Thomas, who is the last original member still around, by the way, and he still tours around the world to this day. And as I've talked about before, Mad Hens Records is in the process of releasing an EP of Charlie, singing three of Dave Rubin's songs. Very soon now, so watch for that. Well, next week I'll be talking about another momentous event on This Week in Music History. So, hope you like that. All right, well, I'm waiting on another old friend to show up here this evening for a little chat. Mr. Santo Malika, a fixture in the East Village of New York City since the early 80s. While we're waiting for him to get here, I'd like to introduce the other new addition to the show. And I'm calling it Guess the Mystery Song. My hope is that this will be an incentive for you to get into the chat room, because that's how you're going to be contacting me with your answer. It's real simple to use the chat room. Doesn't cost anything. You can log on anonymously or be yourself. You just simply go to the homepage of newvisionsradio.com. On the bottom of that screen, on the right side, you'll see this little bouncing green icon. You click on that and you're in the chat room, ready to go. It's been redesigned, so it's kind of cool now. You can even post pictures. Once I start playing the mystery song, you're going to send me your answer via the chat room. If you guess the answer, I'll direct you to send me an email with your address, and then I'll send you a copy of my 2016 CD, Mad as Ever. I know, it sounds like a little shameless bit of self-promotion, but that's all I got to offer. There's no money here. All right, let's do it. I think tonight's song is a little easy, although I could be wrong. Let's see. I need the name of the song, the group singing it, and the lead singer of the song. Here it is. Good luck.
Well, I'm looking for my girl. I wonder, well, can she be? Looking for my girl. I wonder, well, can she be? No, she's somewhere waiting there for me. Yeah, I'm in a U-boat in a place called Fort Worth. We met a year ago in a place called Fort Worth. I wonder, where did my girl go? Well, I'm looking for my girl. I wonder, where did she go? Yeah, I'm looking for my girl. I wonder, where did she go?
Well, I went to England, France, and Spain. I said, "Wow, I meant it to me." I've been here a long time. I wonder, where can she be?
Well, I'm looking for my girl. I wonder, where did she go? Yeah, I'm looking for my girl. I wonder, where did she go?
All right, what an awesome song. I'm going to keep that a secret until next week. Unless, of course, you're in the chat room. If somebody answers it and gets the right answer, anybody in the chat room is going to know it. All right, I'm still waiting for my friend Santo to show up here. Oh, I think he's here. All right, Santo, nice to have you on the show. Glad you can make it out, man. It's been 27 years. You're one of the first guys I met when I moved on to 9th Street back in 1983. And you go back even further than that. Let me ask you, you're a New York guy from birth, right?
John, yeah, I was born and raised in the South Bronx and then moved to the East Village.
That's, amazing. I moved to New York and didn't know anything about the culture of New York when I moved there. And soon found out, people who live in New York and have been there all their lives is a diehard feeling of New York, man. We're New Yorkers, and especially people who are from the East Village, which I lived at, you know, 9th Street and 2nd Avenue. People who are from that area have a real strong feeling about that particular part of New York.
Yeah, well, it's definitely unto itself, and it's been a magnet through the years for people coming. Like you said, you know, people coming to want to do something. I usually tell people it's like a magnet for a lot of the misfits of the world that come there, you know, and that's not meant derogatory, but it's like when if you're out of place where you are, you come there and you're in place amongst all the other people who are out of place, you know, and so whether you're, you know, an artist, whether it's visual or music, you know, things of that nature, you come there and you can be, you know, you would, back in the day, at least, you, rents were cheap, living was somewhat cheap, so, you know, you would, there was a form of cafe society going on where people would do any kind of jobs, waitressing or whatever, delivering newspapers, whatever they could do. And they'd be able to survive and then do their art, whatever it was, music or painting or what have you, you know, and do it there, you know. And, you know, the beatniks were there before us, and then the hippies came there, the Fillmore was there. I mean, there's a lot of history on the streets, you know.
Sure.
Jewish theater even before that. The interesting thing, I was reading George Burns' autobiography, and who was a comedian back in the day with Burns and Allen.
Sure, I remember him.
George Burns, and he's talking about 2nd Avenue. I went to, you know, 2nd Avenue, 6th Street to the Taylor there. And again, my man, he was talking all this stuff about the theaters that were on 2nd Avenue. And I was like, whoa, you know, that's how long people have been coming here that didn't have a lot of money, that were making do, you know, came and made do, you know. So it definitely has a history that drew people in and encouraged people to contribute to it, you know. So
right.
You know, that was a good, that's what I think the good thing about it, too. Because people could come, like, yeah, like yourself, you came and you added your thing to it, you know. So then you became part of it and it became part of you, you know.
I missed that part of my life, you know, when I lived in the city there. I learned so much and met so many great people. I mean, it's really where I, you know, cut my teeth in playing.
Yeah, yeah.
When I first moved there, I mean, every night I'd go out to a different bar, a different club. You know, there were so many in that area.
Yeah.
And you'd just go in there and play for free and just get to know people. And all the people that I met, a lot of them, it turned out to have gigs for me. It was a great, great time.
Yeah.
I was looking online and saw that you actually moved into 331 East 9th.
That's right, yeah.
In 1979, I think, right?
Yeah, I got there in 79, and it was, you know, I had ideas of, I was in college, I was going to Hunter College, and I always had thoughts of, like, I was going down to Soho, which was, like, pretty much starting to happen, and, like, a few years before that was happening, there was all these, a lot of lofts and things of that nature that were converted. They weren't really living spaces. They were commercial spaces, old factories, and artists were coming in, again, because the factories had moved out for whatever economic reasons, and they had these big spaces, and people were living in there, painting, playing all kinds of experimental music. Like the loft jazz stuff was going on at the time, which was really out there. Some of that stuff was out there. And they were living there and doing this, and I was like, yeah, you know, this is the thing to do. I was from the Bronx, but I was like, you know, the Bronx is all right, but, you know, I wanted that, you know, I wanted to be that, you know, and play, you know, play and just, you know, mind, have your mind expanded, you know, and just see, you know, explore the possibilities and be part of it, you know. So I was coming from that, but I couldn't afford the loss because they were just, at that point, it was starting to get to be too much money and required a lot of work. So I had this storefront. I was looking at The Voice was like my Bible at the time, especially for the classifieds. But you could get gigs off of that, sell instruments through that, find apartments. I mean, that was really, it was the Craigslist of its
day. I remember reading The Voice every week, man, before I had an apartment.
It came out on Wednesdays, you grab it, okay, what can I see, you know. And there was an ad in there for a storefront on 9th Street, and I thought, well, let me go check it out. And I checked it out, and it looked like a good thing. You know, back then you would pay what they call a fixture fee. To take over the lease and take the place, you know. And I didn't have any money on hand. I didn't know. I think they wanted maybe, I forget, $1,500 or something for the fixture fee. And I had this Carlo Rovelli electric guitar that was like a, you know, an imitation of a Gibson, you know, semi-hollow, you know, F-hole cut and everything.
Right.
So I was like, okay. So there was a pawn shop down on 3rd Street and 2nd Avenue. I went down there, pawned the guitar, got like $40 for it. And I went back to the guys who had the store for it, and I saw them, and I gave them the $40 as a deposit, and that's how I got the place. You know, and I just stood there ever since. Yeah.
Wow. Now, when you got the place, what was your concept? What were you thinking to do with it? Did you have in mind to make a coffee shop?
No. It was just it was all those storefronts were livings. There was no business in the East Village, really. I mean, unless you were, you know, Catches, or if you were, you know, the coffee shop, the bodega. I mean, that's the only business there. Everything else was people living in storefronts, and pretty much that, you know. I mean, that was it. And, you know, some people selling drugs out of the storefronts, but most of it was just people living and stuff.
But your lease was a multi-use, so you knew you could make...
No, what the landlords did, see, they weren't stupid. They gave everybody commercial leases, even though they knew you were living there. And they would say, well, say it's a doctor's office in case anybody asks, you know. So they would, you know, my neighbor was, you know, a doctor, you know, and she wasn't really no doctor, but she was like doctor whatever, you know. And,
so what was the advantage for them having a commercial lease with you?
Well, they could end it at any time. It wasn't subject to any regulations. Not at any time. If they gave you a two-year lease, 2 years, you're out. You can't say nothing about it because you term of the lease and you're out, you know. So they would do that, and they weren't responsible for fixing anything because it was commercial. It was on you to fix it, and they weren't bound by any regulations, any rental regulations. You know, stabilization laws, they're pretty, you know, not severe, but they make you do things, you know. They make you keep something
right.
Livable, you know, and you got to put money into it and all that kind of stuff. So their thing was, you know, just say you're a doctor or something in case anybody asks, you know, we'll give you another lease.
Wow.
So I went a number of years with just two-year leases. And we were living there. I was living there, and then we did a few shows. We thought, oh, let's have maybe some acoustic shows. And so we did that for a little while, where we have like a music and a magician.
You sponsored the shows.
Yeah, put them on. Yeah, we would charge like $5 to get in, and have whatever a little like you know like wine and maybe some kind of popcorn or some shit like that. You know that we would just. You know, give to people when they came in, and everybody did a set, you know, and that was it. Do a set and then move on. And then somebody called the fire department, because a few doors down, there was a place called the Psychedelic is the Creator. They were these guys that were there. It was like the Church of the Psychedelic. That's what they were. And they had this big psychedelic thing painted on the window. The window was plywood. It wasn't even a window. And something was going on in there that night, and they called the fire department, apparently on them, but the fire department came to us instead, and we had people in there, and they were like, oh, you can't do this, you know, and all this kind of stuff, so that put a squash on that, so we stopped doing that, and then I tried doing a little recording studio for a little while, because this is pre-digital, the recording studio then, you gotta have bucks to do it,
right.
You gotta do it for real, you know,
right.
Everything was, you know, either one-inch tape or whatever. But I had like a Tascam 4-track. I did that for a while. The stuff that we recorded.
4-track cassette.
Yeah. Wasn't the cassette. It was right before the cassette. I think I had the reel-to-reel. The Tascam reel-to-reel that they had. It might have been a quarter-inch 4-track. I think that's what I had. And I recorded some stuff with that. I did a little bit of recording, but, you know, with that, you had to commit to it, really. You couldn't just do it part-time or, you know, it wasn't going to work. And then after that, I thought, okay, you know, I had to get something going. That was really the thing. I just had to get something going. And I was doing, like, layouts and designs for people, for, like, actresses or whatever, like, postcards or just whatever people needed, some kind of layout and design thing.
And you just picked that up on your own? How did you learn to do that?
Well, from doing things for myself, I was doing gigs. I was playing music and doing the clubs and showcases and all that. So I had to do things for myself, flyers and things like that. So there used to be this thing, you know, called press type, it was called. It was like rub-on letters. And you would do that, because, again, this is before digital, before computers.
Sure.
So there was typesetting, again, it was for real. If you wanted to get something typeset, you had to go pay bucks, and you had to go to a certain place where they would do it, and, you know, and they had to print it out with, like, chemicals and whatnot. It was like a whole other, that industry was a whole other animal. But press type, you could just, you know, you rub it all up. It looks like it was typeset. And,
right.
You know, and then you get it printed. I used to have a hard time getting stuff printed because people didn't really need, like, the printing industry was geared for its volume, you know, 1,000 of this, you know, 1,000 of that.
Exactly.
You're doing gigs, you don't need 1,000 of these things.
I need 50, man.
Yeah, you know, 50, 100, something like that. And it was real hard finding places for that to happen because it wasn't an industry yet, you know. Again, pre-Kinko's, pre-Staple, all of that kind of stuff. It was just the printing industry. And then some little coffee shops that geared more to lawyers, because lawyers had a lot of that kind of work, you know, with briefs and all that kind of stuff, you know. I had done some, you know, just pickup work, overnight stuff for people like that. So I thought this might not be a bad thing to try, you know. And then the Japanese started coming out with these smaller machines at that time. So the whole industry was going through a change, you know, the whole printing copy industry, you know, because before that it was these big machines that took up a whole room, so, you know, Kodak, Xerox, you know, big American guys were like, oh. So then these Japanese started putting these things out. They were good machines. They looked good. So I was able to talk somebody to give me a lease. I got a lease for a machine, and then we opened up the store and just kept going from there. I mean, it was mostly to have a job. I mean, you know, so in the morning I was working with this guy who used to handicap horses, like a Belmont racetrack, aqueduct. So I'd go up to his place, and he had a little mimeo machine. So he would, whatever, get his info from the tracks, because they start early in the morning.
Right.
He would crank out these little tip sheets, and then I would deliver them to all these newsstands. He had a little route. So I'd go up there, I'd do that, do my route, and then I'd come down, open the store up, and, you know, be there the rest of the day, you know, and then do some gigs at night, or whatever, piecing it together.
So this started probably 82, you say, that's when you opened up the store?
Yeah, that's when the store opened up. So from 79 to 82, it was doing odd jobs, doing the recording, studio thing, you know, just trying different things, you know.
Now, I moved into that apartment next to you in August of 83, so it was a year after you opened.
Yeah, just opened up, yeah.
And you were already, like, you know, a permanent fixture there. It was like, wow, you know, I'm seeing people coming in and out of your store. And I got to know you right away, one of the few people that I knew that could tell me the real deal down there. I think that first summer I touched my marimba next door to you, and we did a little recording.
Yeah, yeah.
And one of the songs that you brought over to me on CD.
Yeah.
You still have that song? Okay. Wow, man.
Yeah, Games for Fools, it was called. Yeah.
Right, Games for Fools.
That was the time. And then rap was coming up around that time, so I tried to throw a little bit of that into that song. And, you know, things I was trying to do acoustically, it wasn't a big acoustic time then, too, because it was really before I mean, now there's more folk and acoustic stuff going on, you know. What I was trying to do then, it wasn't really that much. Rap was happening on one side, punk on the other, so that's really what was dominating. So it was hard to get gigs and stuff.
Well, it seems like causes that you espouse were all about New York, you know, the East Village, trying to save the village, and, you know, about growing up in the city there.
Yeah.
So a lot of those things seem to mirror your life in the city.
Well, they're definitely, you know, autobiographical. They definitely are, you know. And yeah, I always came from the theory of writing, you know, write about what you know. You know, that was what I was taught, and that's what I always try to follow through. I mean, and as I wrote, I mean, I knew, you know, I wasn't a great singer, really, so I knew me trying to do, you know, baby songs and all that. I wasn't going to fly for me. I mean, you know, so I tried to do what I was good at doing and just, you know, and try to just gear it a certain way, maybe make the rhythm take over. I was good on rhythm, always like that, in that way, not just finger-picking acoustic music. That, to me, like, that was acoustic music up until then. It was a lot of finger-picking stuff. The aggressive stuff is more electric.
Well, you know, I'd like to take a break here and play one of your songs,
okay.
You know, just to give the listeners a little idea of some East Village type music. I picked one called The Street.
Okay, The Street, yeah, that's a great one, and I really enjoy that. That's a little more produced, actually, than some other stuff, than some of the other ones.
Let's take a listen.
Street has eyes and ears. Yeah.
care knows what you love. If you hold dear, she has a heart as gold. It'll give you that bounce in your walk to do what it's cold. The hunting lamb, they lurk in the shadows, just awaiting on their prey. And with the God bless you, brother, can you spare another dollar to take your money? I'll send you on your way. They're down the chance for the special of the day. And when they fill their sack, they get a dollar back. It's the Bible of the fittest. Five years in way. It's too much interesting. It remembers the face, but it's on your name. You just play this game, and no matter who you are, the rules are the same. And no matter who you are, the rules are the same. And no matter who you are, the rules are the same.
All right, that was The Street. Tell me a little bit about that song. For one, did you record that in your apartment?
No, actually, that was done this place called Monkey Hill Studio. It was out in Queens, and it was like a big deal, you know, 2-inch, 24 track, and all of that. It was the second album I had put out. It's called Music from the Street, and I had done this first album called The American Way, which I had mostly done in my place on the H. Actually, I had an 8-track. That was an 8-track. Fantastic. I missed it then. And I had done that. I was putting it out there, you know, trying to get somebody interested, really. And I had met someone. I met this girl that was an assistant to somebody at RCA, one of the guys there, the executives there. And she heard the stuff. She was like, "Oh, you know, this is good." And as record companies do, I want to hear more. I want to hear more. I want to hear more. You know, but not only do I want to hear more, but they want to hear something produced more and more. Because the first one was pretty much bare bones. 8-track and, you know, not like done up big, you know. So I was like, but nobody, they didn't want to put any money up for it, you know, so I had to pay for it, you know. So I, from a friend of a friend, this guy had the studio in Queens, College Point, Queens. It was called Monkey Hill Studio, and I'd go there midnight to 8 and do these sessions to have this album come out, Music from the Street album. And there was that. There was another song called Lily Sina. They had that same kind of, you know, like people on the corner jamming, you know, just the congas and all the bells and whatnot, you know, just, jamming up kind of thing.
Now, Lower East Side is actually a slang for Lower East Side, right?
Right, that's kind of, yeah, that's what the Latinos would call it. And there was a place like we used to call Avenue A, B, and C, Alphabet City. And the Latinos down there, they would, sort of, when they would come, instead of saying Lower East Side, it was Lower East Side. And that was another of the tunes that's on there. It's called Lower East Side.
Now, it's funny you mentioned, you know, the record companies at that time, and I guess this was probably late 80s, in the early 90s?
Yeah, not 90s, but maybe between, it was before 89, so somewhere, between 86 and 89, maybe in that area, yeah.
And by the time it got to that period of time, it got to be easier to record your own stuff, so I think everybody had, like, a small studio, so I think the big studios reacted to that. And they demanded that you have more things prepared. They weren't going to pay because they knew that anybody who had anything going on at all was going to be able to do it themselves, and right. They didn't have to pay the money for it.
Right. It was a big DIY time. That's really was the start of it. You know, and I was getting a lot of play on College Station because they weren't yet co-opted by the Columbias and all that, the Columbia Records and all of that. So I was charting on, like, some College Stations and getting some play there. And getting some decent reviews, a voice had nice review. There was a few things. I mean, it was like starting to gather some steam, but not enough to really use it as a living or anything like that.
In addition to playing your own music, you've done a lot of gigs as a percussionist for other people.
Right, that was later on. That was usually after 90.
After 90.
Yeah.
Do you still continue to find work in the city as a percussionist, or are you mainly still your own guy singing and playing your songs?
I stopped doing me, and I was mostly backing people up, and then that was a good run, you know, for a good 10-15 years. And lately, it's just been just laid back. I don't really get as much calls as I was getting before, you know. But I like doing that. I like being a side guy. You know, from being the main guy, it was nice being the side guy, to tell you the truth, you know.
It's less work.
Yeah, you show up and you play, you know.
None of the hassles. Having to book the gigs,
exactly.
And paying everybody and keeping the band together.
Definitely. And if, you know, whatever the crowd is, doesn't matter. You know, I found that's what got me at the end of doing my thing. It was too much of that stuff. The music had taken a back seat to the count of the house, right. The club owners, you know, and doing all that. And I'm like, you know, it's a good gig if I play and I play in tune, you know, and I get to
right.
That's it. But then you deal with the other part of it. It's like, well, now it's not a good gig. Well, what the hell? What am I
right.
looking for? You know?
And it's the non-music stuff that'll kill you every time.
Definitely. And it got to me, and I was like, okay, but I still love to play, so maybe I could use the knowledge I have and everything in other ways. And I had been playing percussion. I mean, I started when I was a kid playing percussion in church and stuff, so that was where I even started before guitar, you know, and then I had drifted away and got into guitar more. I was like, well, let me get back to that, and I studied with this guy, Frank Molyneux, for a while, and picked up stuff from him, and then I stepped out. Baba Tunji, I studied with him a little bit, or Tunji, and that was really fun, you know, doing that, and then I said, well, let me try it, you know, and again, I got gigs in the areas, doing things, you know, cover bands mostly, things of that nature, some original stuff, but it was good, and, you know, I enjoyed doing it, and I still like playing, you know, and that's playing percussion.
Well, we had a great reuniting a few years after I moved out here. One of my clients who came out to record, turns out he knew you and played with you in the city. And lo and behold, he brings you out here to record. And it's like, wow, man, Santa, come on in, man, come on in. And you had some pretty cool instruments that you were playing for that particular session. Things that I had heard before, but never really sat and tried playing it myself. You had it was like a water stick, I think it was
called.
A rain stick.
Yeah, it had like little seeds in it and stuff, and you would get that kind of sound. And then different chimes and different effects, you know. Different, you know, when you get into the Brazilian stuff, they mimic a lot of the, like, jungle sounds almost, you know.
Right.
And it's percussive, but it's got this whole other thing to it, like things that you know, twirl around that would make these different sounds and everything. It was really pretty cool.
I find the best music in the world imitates what's going on around it.
Yeah, sure, that's definitely true.
And so it's not surprising that the sounds from Brazil are going to be what they hear in the woods.
Yeah, which is what their territory is. Those sessions are funny because his thing was no rehearsal, just show up and I'm going to play and then you play, you know, whatever I play, you play to it, you know, and that was like his concept, you know.
Right.
And he had like, I think, 3 percussionists and, you know, I forget where we played this uptown place. It wasn't Trams, but it was somewhere uptown, like in West 72nd Street. It was really like, didn't seem like.
This is Sean.
Yeah, yeah.
He played on 57th Street at this place. It was between 7th and 8th. It's a pretty well known little place that I saw him at. I'm thinking it's some kind of a Halloween kind of name.
But it was like more of an uptown thing. It wasn't like a down, you know, village joint. It was like people were dressed and it was just
okay.
And it was weird because they kind of didn't know what to make of the whole thing.
Right.
They were checking it out. Some were getting into it, but other ones were like, it might have been like a corporate party or something. I forget even what it was. But we did a few gigs with him. It was interesting, you know, to do it with that. And it kind of worked on some. Sometimes it works. Sometimes, you know, those things are hard to do, you know. I mean,
He was a fun guy.
Yeah.
He was a young guy. He was probably 21 or 22 when he came out here.
Yeah.
Was just out of, I guess he came from somewhere in the Midwest.
Right.
And, you know, he was all gung-ho about,
definitely,
you know, bringing his
money out there and everything.
Yeah. He ended up working for a record label, I think,
yeah,
you know, in the front office,
oh,
doing some stuff. New York's a hard place. It beats you down after a while. It can, in a way.
Definitely, yeah. I mean, you gotta see it, you know. You gotta see it for what it is. Realize what you want to do and what's good for you to do, and then go from there. I mean, you can't buy into it, into the hype and into all this other people's stuff. I mean,
and it's a reality check. You know, what worked in your little town doesn't necessarily fly when you get to New York. You know, those that can stick it out in New York are the ones that, you know, have something to offer.
Yeah, I mean, it's good. It's good for that. I don't think, if you wind up leaving, I don't think it's a bad thing. I mean,
no. You
know, it's just ain't for you.
Right.
And I think that's the big thing. In terms of life discovery, like, to me, it's like it's another part of the journey along the way. And you say, okay, you know, I mean, I found it to be a home. So, and I'm in the same place since 79. So, obviously, I mean, I stood there. You know, it just worked out like that, and I was able to stay there. So I felt, you know, there with a little bit of divine intervention, this is where I'm supposed to be, so on.
And you've made it work for you. You're a mainstay on 9th Street. And, you know, people have done, a number of newspapers have done articles on you. You've been involved in the court system trying to make sure that people get their rights taken care of. Tell me a little bit about what happened in the 90s with you. I mean, you almost had to get out of your place, right?
Yeah, they did try to evict. They tried to evict me once, and then we went to court with that and won the case because basically because I was there so long, we were grandfathered in, really. Being there from 79. This happened in the 90s. Because a new landlord came. Not a new landlord, but someone else took over. Same landlords, but somebody's daughter took over or something, you know, and they wanted to bring in a new regime and what they wanted to do, and I didn't fit the mold, I guess, or whatever, so they tried to get me out, and once we went to court, everything that they had done through the years turned up, like putting intercoms in my place, and, you know, and installing low-flow toilets, and putting in new windows, and then they were saying that they didn't know I was even there, or that I lived there, or that I had anything there this whole time, so... You know, we went to court, the truth kind of came out, and it showed how they were just trying to, you know, they were lying to get through it. And then they cut my electricity. That was the second thing. That was the big thing. And they tried to get me out. After they lost the first set of court that wound up going to the Supreme Court in New York, and all their appeals were shot down, you know, we also set a precedent with the Supreme Court of New York that basically if you allow something to happen for a period of time, like 20 years, you can't all of a sudden say, no,
right.
It's not, we're not going to let it happen no more.
Right.
And you've effectively enabled it to happen, so you've agreed to it happening. And you can't just pull the plug, you know. So that's what that decision was, you know. And then when they realized they couldn't get me out there, they cut my electricity and tried to get me out that way. I was blowing fuses and wondering why I was like blowing fuses when I never did before. You know, it happened on a Thanksgiving weekend. They thought I wasn't going to be around. They sent some electrician in and rewired the place. So instead of me having four lines, I had two lines of electrical power coming into my place. So I started blowing fuses. I was like, man, what's going on? You know, and the fuses were in the basement. They were these like old glass fuses. One thing led to another. I realized what they had done. I sued them, I took them to civil court to sue them as people trying to basically do harm to me, you know,
right.
On that level. And then they tried to get me arrested for trespassing, but I went to the basement to try to change the fuses, you know, and they called the fire department on me and all kinds of stuff, man, EPA, because I got a generator, because they wouldn't let me get anybody in there to work on the electrical situation. But they said nothing's wrong. I said, well, yeah, something is wrong because I'm blowing fuses, and I never was before. So they wouldn't let me fix it. They wouldn't fix it. And I couldn't survive like that because everything was electrical in the whole place.
Sure.
You know, there's no gas, so everything I cooked was electrical. The business itself was all electrical, and it was coffee machines and whatnot, which all took, you know...
Your livelihood.
Yeah, and air conditioners and all that. So I got a generator. And I did a little research. I saw a lot of these halal guys had generators on the street. So I figured if they can use it on the street, I could use it on the street too. It shouldn't be a problem, you know. So I bought this little Honda generator, put it in the front of the store, and then, you know, just wired it. So when during the day, I would plug in, and, you know, from the generator into the store. But it was outside the whole time. And at night, I would put it in my van because I couldn't store it in the store because I had gas. And that would have been against the law to do that, you know. So I would put it in my van at night, take it out in the morning. There was a gas station on 2nd Street. I'd get 2 gallons of gas, because that was like the legal limit that you could use for generators in the city. Fill it up with 2 gallons of gas, use the 2 gallons all day, and then put it in the van at night, you know. And then they called the EPA on me, because they said, you know, the fumes, but the fumes for this generator were legal within what you could use in the city and stuff. But
how long did this last?
The generator situation lasted about a year.
Whoa.
Yeah, it was about a year. And the other stuff, but then we kept going to court, and they kept, you know, bouncing it off. The judge didn't want to deal with it, really, because the judges never really want to deal with the landlord tenant kind of stuff, you know, especially the civil court. They don't really like getting involved, you know. And they didn't want to hear it. And then finally we had the trial, and I was on, you know, started testifying, I was on the stand, and then we broke for lunch because, you know, judges, they're taking their lunch at 1 o'clock. They don't want to hear nothing.
Sure.
And he said, look, you know, I testified for about 45 minutes, and he goes, you know, it goes to them. You guys should probably settle this because you wouldn't like, you're probably not going to like what I have to say if you keep this going. He told them. And then there was a settlement. Then the lawyers took over and worked it all out, and I wound up getting my lease, and I've been there, you know. Yeah, legit and whatnot since then, you know,
you weren't lying down, man. You weren't taking it. You were taking this thing serious, and you know, you're a strong dude.
Well,
you know.
You know, I had nothing. You know, that was all I had. So I mean, if I was gonna go, I was gonna go down swinging, and you know, I was gonna go down the flame, so to speak. You know, and then whatever happened happened. I mean, I couldn't not fight. I just couldn't. You know, I just thought this is
sure.
I don't do this, you know, so.
Now, I'd like my listeners to know exactly the name of your place and my recommendation is to go there if you need any kind of work, like business cards, copies of anything. Go in the city, 9th Street and 2nd Avenue, and check out Santo and his wife, Margaret. And what's the dog's name again?
Oh, yeah, Curtis.
And Curtis.
Yeah. Curtis Mayfield.
Tell everybody about some more stuff that they can get from your store. Because you're like a one-off, and you cater to the local people there.
Exactly,
and
yeah. And actually, if you even send stuff in. You can send stuff in. You don't have to, you know, you can then just come down and pick it up or whatever. But we do a lot of stuff online, and like stickers, you know, rolls of stickers, and that's good for promo, like labels and stickers. People send us artwork, put them on stickers, rubber stamps, do a lot of stuff like that. People send us artwork to do their own custom rubber stamps, you know, as well as name and addresses. You know, I mean, we do the standard stuff too, but I mean, a lot of the stuff we cater to is people send a lot of artwork. We do stickers with the artwork. Presentations, any kind of, you know, if you have any kind of meetings coming up, we do presentations, you know, things of that nature, bindings, spiral bindings, and things of that nature. Color copies, black and white. We do dupes from, like, people have been lately bringing in a lot of their old VHS tapes of the family and one of their, you know, like their father.
Sure.
And so we do that, put them on DVD for people. Getting some old cassette mixtapes that people would make, putting them on CD for them, you know, that kind of thing.
I'm telling you, people, if you have any need for any of those services, look online, the
yeah,
Source
yeah,
Limited.
Unlimited. SourceUnltd.com. And that usually comes up. You can see we've got a bunch of reviews on Yelp, so you'll see what people have to say. And you can send stuff in, like I said, and then we can just go from there and work things out with you, whatever you need. You know, we're definitely going to work with people. You know.
I still get my business cards from you.
That's right.
You know, it's really worth it. I mean, you know, you're such a personable guy, and, you know, it's not like dealing with, you know, these monsters. I mean, you're a true spirit. You're a kindred spirit to artists and musicians, and you deal with those kind of people. And,
And, you know, I think that's what really, you know, that's what we got to do, really, especially now with the political situation is what it is. You got to be working together.
Yeah, resist.
Yeah, resist, and you know, and be a unit, you know, and keep things going on a human level, you know, because it's we all have to make money to survive, but it's what you do to make the money. That's the thing, and you can do things that aren't hurting other people to do that. You know?
Awesome. I have another song queued up I want to play. I just want to recount one little unique story about your place. That I'm sure you've had many, many more than just one of them. But I was watching TV. It's been a good decade now. But I was watching a Law and Order version one night, and all of a sudden, I'm going, wait a minute, that looks like my apartment. And your store was in the episode. They changed the name of it for that show,
well,
though.
Yeah, they did. They had. I don't know why they did. That was just they wanted to make it a dress store or something like that. And they kept throwing the guy against the window. That was
yeah.
The thing. I just told him, yo, man, you know, that window isn't that sturdy. So
that block has got a lot of character. You know, filmmakers want to use it quite often. It's a unique block.
Yeah, we were in this other one, too. It's called My Italian Husband. Some guy came here from Italy, got remarried, had a new family. His wife came to look for him. And she comes into a coffee shop to make flyers. You see this guy, and we were the place.
And what was it called again?
My Italian Husband.
I'm going to look for that.
Yeah,
I got to look
for
that.
Indie. That was an indie one. And they had some guy, hey, I voice like that.
Awesome.
What do you want?
Now, the song I picked out, Santo, which is kind of apropos for, you know, what's going on in that area. It's called The Change.
Oh, The Change, yeah.
Right, so you want to tell me a little bit about that song?
Yeah, that was, when I had written it, it was about a particular person that I was involved with at the time. But as the years went on, it kind of branched out in my mind to other things, you know, which is like the hook of it was, I can't believe the change that came over you. You know, it's like you think you know somebody, and you really think you know somebody, and then all of a sudden, you know, they're not that person you thought, or things happen that they become something else. And that's what that was, you know, someone I thought I knew, I can't believe the change that came over you, you know, and that's kind of what it was about, you know.
Let's listen to it. The Change. That was The Change. Santo. Awesome stuff. You know, we're at the end of our segment here. Hard to believe.
Oh, it went quick, man.
Well, it always does when you're talking with friends. And it's been a unique time sharing your perspectives on New York. You know, I miss it like crazy, man. I mean, you know, obviously you can't go backwards, and, you know, I got a life out here now. But I got fond memories of New York, man. And anytime I can reconnect with it, you know, I'm there, man. Let's do it again. I'm sorry your wife didn't make it out, Margaret. You know, we had a good connection with her too, and she's a little busy today, so she couldn't make it.
Yeah, she's good people. She's good, and she, which I'm, you might not know. I mean, she's had like a life, almost a lifelong struggle with MS, multiple sclerosis.
Yeah.
And she got it in '86, and she's been 1986, and she's been living with it since then. And she's a real trooper. I mean, I learned a lot from her in terms of just being. I mean, because, you know, it's hard, you know, it's hard to bitch about anything when you see somebody who's got an illness, who's getting up every day and going to work and doing their thing, you know.
Sure.
But you can't really, it kind of keeps a lid on your thing and your perspective of, you know, what to do and what not to do. So, yeah, she's great. She's been great and a great partner to have for this whole time.
Yeah. Well, you're both great people. And this is awesome having you out here. I hope you had a good time on the show.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
I have one more song I want to play.
Okay.
That kind of impacted me. It's called "Help Us to Survive."
Help us to survive, and that's what it is. Lord, help us to survive. It's it was more written during a Reagan time, which kind of is a mirror of what's kind of going on now. You know, we're going back a few years, but then there was a little more deception going on, and that was the thing about it, as you'll see in the lyrics of the song. You know, it's hard to tell between the good and the bad guys, because, you know, everybody was like, oh, Reagan was coming in on his horse, and hey, he was going to, you know, save America. But meanwhile, there's a lot of underhanded stuff going on that was hurting people, you know, and this is what came out of it.
Things are cyclical, aren't they?
They definitely are, you know, and it's funny that you don't know that until you've been blessed to live at least a certain amount of time that you could say that, you know.
To see the next cycle.
Like, you never know. I mean, you know, I would never have known in 1980 or whatever that, you know, I'm writing this now and it's going to come into, you know, it's still going to be relevant in years from now. And a lot of this stuff kind of is, you know, which amazes me. It's like things have not to pat myself on that, it's just that things have not really changed that
right,
much.
Right.
I mean, the world is what it is. Politics is what it is. Always probably will be. And
politics are politics.
Exactly. And we just got to get through it.
Well, Santa, as we leave here, Let's listen to "Help Us to Survive."
You got it.
All right.
Great afternoon, man. Thanks a lot, bro.
You've been listening to The Hour of Madness with Santo.
Fucking truth, who's telling lies? It's hard to tell these days between the good and the bad guys. And everyone's wearing colors, so they just black or white. You try taking an honest stand, and you're best ready to fight. I am all out start each day. Before I go to bed at night, I pray, Lord, help us to survive. Lord, help us to survive. I'll never ask you, who's getting the bills, man? Who's my son? And how come the more you kill, the more they ask for more? And why has it become so hard? So what's wrong from right? Gotta take a moral stand, and you're in for a lonely night. I am, before I start each day. Before I go to bed at night, I pray, Lord, help us to survive. Dear Lord, help us to survive. Lord, help us, Lord, help us to survive. Lord, help us, Lord, help us to survive. Lord, help us, Lord, help us to survive. Who's talking truth? Who's telling lies? And who are these people? Because nothing with our lives. We
join the hand of friendship. It comes a slap in the face. You try to find some peace of mind when you've got it all over the place. Before I start each day, before I go to bed at night, I pray, Lord, help us to survive. And Lord, help us to survive.